It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Recently, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided two cases on the same day, both concerning expert testimony in criminal cases. In one case, on eyewitness testimony, a majority changed the longstanding rule that no experts on the problems with eyewitnesses' testimony were allowed. From this point forward, the Supreme Court said trial courts in Pennsylvania may permit experts. But in the other case, the court said exactly the opposite regarding expert testimony on what can create a false confession. Pitt Law Professor David Harris joins us to explain how this will impact future trials in the Commonwealth. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's good to be with you again.
I tried to explain that in a nutshell. Hopefully, I was able to at least get it up on the tee for you to take it further for us.
Oh, you did well. You did well.
On the same day, the same court, same issue, Pennsylvania Supreme Court makes two opposite decisions. So what's the issue and what did they decide?
Well, the issue in both cases is whether the defense can bring in an expert who would bring the jury scientific and research-based information about a crucial aspect of the evidence. In one case, it was about eyewitness testimony. In another, it was about whether a confession could be a false confession. What are the risk factors for creating false confessions? Now, we know at this point in time, we know for a certainty that both eyewitness identification and confessions will generate errors in a certain percentage of cases. We know this because of the hundreds of DNA-based exonerations we already have. In those cases, which represent the tip of the iceberg, because not every case, in fact, very few cases have DNA issues in them, but in those cases, 75% of those cases have eyewitness identification mistakes. That really tells you a lot about the frailty of eyewitness identification evidence.
And let's explain why there are so many eyewitness errors among eyewitnesses giving testimony.
Well, the research on this goes back at least three decades, and what we have learned is that our concept of eyewitness testimony, or being an eyewitness as a kind of using a video recorder, you see an event, something happens, you record it, and then you sit in court and you play it back. Human memory.
You're talking about that in a metaphorical
sense. Exactly, in a metaphorical sense. That's how we thought about it. And it turns out the research is crystal clear. Memory is not like that at all. Memory is much more like trace evidence. In other words, it's a very fluid, flexible, small part of the way that people process information. So there are a number of things that can cause eyewitness testimony to go wrong. The stress in which somebody views something will affect its accuracy. Focus on a weapon, which is often the case in a criminal scenario, will cause somebody to be less accurate. Cross-racial identification, when a white person is trying to identify a black person or the other way around, those things make identifications less accurate. And there's a whole host of other factors that come from the police procedures that have been used for years and years to sort out one suspect from the rest of the people in a lineup. And so it turns out we know for certain that eyewitness identification testimony, which we used to think was so accurate and so important, is actually pretty weak evidence. And so an expert would come into a criminal case where eyewitness identification is the issue, and the expert would say, not, you should not believe the eyewitness. Nothing like that. The expert would say, here are the overall issues with eyewitness testimony. And so, and doing that would educate the jury as to the weakness or positive aspects of eyewitness identification in general. And so, that's what the contention was about in that case.
So this is an expert who's brought in to testify, not necessarily to poke holes in the specific testimony of an eyewitness.
That's right. Not
but
to do that.
Just to say, overall, here are the errors that often come up when an eyewitness testifies, and here is why, and this is for the edification of the jury, and that apparently is, according to the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, perfectly okay.
Well, for years, their rule had been absolutely not. And but this now, case, the Walker case, changed that to we will now permit, not require, but permit experts to testify that way in eyewitness identification cases.
So now there is the case of the false confession.
Correct.
Now, and this is an expert who comes in to do – this is regarding an expert, a ruling regarding an expert to come who comes in to do what?
In the Alicia case, which is decided the same day, the defense again wants to bring in an expert. But this time the crucial issue is – the truth or falsity of a confession. A confession has been given. It is now contended that it was untrue, and it came about through pressure and other kinds of things. So the defense wants to bring in an expert, again, not to say you should not believe or you should believe this witness, but to educate the jury generally as to what kinds of factors are at play when a confession is being sought by the police and how these create or can create a risk of a confession, a false confession being given. Just like with the eyewitness identification cases, we know from DNA exonerations that, believe it or not, false confessions do happen. I know that's hard for a lot of people to swallow, but it's true. They come up in 25% of all of the exoneration cases, which is quite substantial. And so the idea, again, is to educate the jury, to give them this scientific background so that they can then evaluate the credibility of the witnesses before them.
Was there a history regarding the testimony of expert witnesses regarding false confessions, just as there had been a history on eyewitness testimony, which was not allowed until just recently?
Great question. In Pennsylvania, there was no rule in the false confession area about experts.
So there was nothing that said you cannot bring in an expert to explain why
right.
there would be a false confession.
Right. And in fact, the trial court in the case that was appealed had allowed the testimony of the expert to go forward on these sorts of general issues, but prohibited the expert from saying anything about the specific aspects of the defendant that might be parts of those risk factors. Nothing specific, only general ideas about how false confessions come about. And the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the prosecuting authorities, appealed the trial court's decision, and that is what was before the PA Supreme Court in the Alicia case, and they ruled we don't want expert testimony on false confessions. That will be prohibited. So they laid down a rule that kept expert testimony out of cases going forward, and even though it was all about educating the jury, they said we don't want this. There's too much of a chance that the jury will take this as an attack on the credibility of the individual people in this case.
There's one other thing I think needs to be explained here, and you know, we can certainly understand the idea or the concept of a testimony that is given or a confession that is made under duress. But there are other reasons why someone might give – why someone might confess to something that they didn't do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is all about pressure. And again, we have years of research on this. It doesn't go back quite as far as the research on eyewitness identification, but there is a long trail of research that goes back at least 15 years that indicates that pressure – legal, by the way, legal types of pressure, pressure that the courts allow – can force people into a position where they feel there's no alternative but to give the police what they want to hear. Pressure such as a statement to the person, we found that you failed the polygraph. Hmm. We found your DNA at the crime scene. We know that you did it. You might as well come clean now, because if you don't, you're going to get the death penalty.
And that's all perfectly legal?
All perfectly wow. legal. But it turns out those kinds of tactics, along with some other well-known tactics that we could discuss if you want, all of those things can lead some people to just say, okay, I'll give them what they want. And when I get out of this room, which is often promised as part of the deal, you confess, we'll get you out of here. Then I'll go to a lawyer. It'll all, you know, we'll fix it. We'll get this all taken care of. But I can't stand the pressure. People feel too much pressure, and that's why they do it.
And by then, they've already confessed to something.
It's too late.
There's a record of that.
It's too late.
And the other thing too is, as I was reading in some of the background on this, there was an individual who cited that, for example, Mr. Alicia has an IQ of 64, is considered to be mentally retarded, and has been on Social Security disability for most of his life. So, and that explains why someone might confess, as was the case here.
It's a significant risk factor to find somebody with a low IQ under interrogation. People often who have that sort of mental pattern are more susceptible to suggestion and don't understand the consequences of what they're doing when they give a statement.
So what's the difference in the opinions that could explain this?
Well, you know, this was what was so interesting to me about it, Paul. If you look at the opinion in the Walker case about eyewitness testimony, what you find is a court saying, you know, it's been 20 years since we ruled on eyewitness testimony and experts. In that 20 years, and I would again contend it's been more than 20, but there's at least 20 years of strong, consistent, accepted evidence in the sciences that shows that eyewitness testimony is not what we thought it was, and that the jury's ideas about how good eyewitness testimony is are often inaccurate and they need to be educated. So science really pervades the Walker opinion. The justice who wrote the opinion, Justice Todd, really comes to grips with it, talks about it, and says that that science must be reckoned with. Of all of the states that have faced these issues on whether to allow an expert to testify, 44 of them allow expert testimony. Pennsylvania is among the four that do not. 10 of the 11 federal circuits allow it. It is high time, in light of the science, that we reevaluate it. And nothing in that says that we are going to tell the jury how to decide the individual case. It's just general principles. If you look at the other case, at the Alicia case, and you do have lots of science, peer-reviewed, published science on the risk factors for false confessions, you find almost no science at all. It isn't even referenced in the Alicia opinion. Instead, it is all about, well, we're uncomfortable with this because we think it's going to cause the jury to reflect on the credibility of the individuals before it, which is exactly what the majority in the eyewitness case says. No, no, no. It's not about the people here. The expert testifies to general ideas. And so they clashed over the absence or presence of science, which one opinion really gets, the other doesn't even acknowledge. And one opinion says, well, this is telling the jury what to do. And the other says, no, no, it's just education. That's all it is. So there's a huge difference in worldview between these two opinions.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're discussing recent and seemingly contradictory decisions by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, State Supreme Court, concerning expert testimony in criminal cases. If you have a question for our guest, Pitt Law Professor David Harris, regarding this somewhat confusing issue, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. And on Twitter at ESSPGH, #EPLive. Again, the number 412-246-2002. David, is Pennsylvania now consistent with best practices, at least with eyewitness testimony?
I'd like to say that it is, but sadly, I don't think so. And here's why. Now, of course, the rule is that experts can testify in eyewitness testimony cases. But what is actually more important at this juncture, I mean, the expert witness issue, can an expert witness come in? That now goes back 30 years in most jurisdictions. This is basically an old argument. And What we really need is a forward-looking discussion of what creates these problems and how to fix them before they happen. So what we should be doing in Pennsylvania is we should be having a deep, long-term discussion about how we change eyewitness testimony practices before a case gets to court. We should move from simultaneous to sequential lineups that where the person is shown individuals or a picture one at a time instead of all together. We've talked about that before on this program. We got to go to blind lineups. We have to have statements given to the witnesses viewing a lineup that says things like the person who did the crime may not be here. All of these things are part of the accepted research now. And some states, and the example I'd hold up is New Jersey, which Justice Todd cited in her opinion, now have this as part of their rules that they follow. So what PA should be doing, what we should be doing now, is laying down rules to fix the problem going forward.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. We have Chris on the line from Rochester. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that even though the cases are being described as opposite decisions, I think they do have something in common, and that's that they were both made judgments made against the defendant. And I wanted to know what your opinion was on that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, well, hang on 1 second. Are you still there?
Okay.
Still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, because David has a quizzical look on his face. Might need you to clarify what you're asking here.
Yeah, Chris, I see the Walker opinion allowing experts as being for the defendant. Why do you think that's against the defendant?
The allowing eyewitness testimony.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm having trouble describing.
Well, here's my take on it, Chris. The Walker opinion about eyewitness testimony allows a defendant to bring in an expert to testify about the general aspects of the failures of eyewitness testimony. Not in every case, but generally what puts that testimony at risk. Whereas the other opinion on false confessions, that is definitely against defendants because it never allows for any expert to come in and talk in even a general way about the risks of false confession. So I see them as opposite and a split.
Does that clear it up for you, Chris?
Yeah, it definitely does. Thank you for explaining that.
Yes.
Sure.
Absolutely, yes. If someone is an expert witness and they are called in by the defense to question the validity of an eyewitness's testimony against that defendant, then that would certainly be something that's helpful to the defendant, whereas the false confession expert who would be able to clarify whether a defendant delivered a confession under duress or because they clearly didn't understand what they were doing to hurt themselves would in fact be beneficial to the defendant.
And is not allowed.
And is not allowed.
It
hurts the defendant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should add that if, under the Walker case, if a defense expert is called, the prosecution has the option of calling its own expert on these general concepts regarding eyewitness testimony. That testimony by the expert for the defense does not have to go unanswered. It can be answered by the prosecution.
Is there a disdain among some justices for social science?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Yes.
The idea being that this may be a hurdle that they just simply can't get over to make that leap of faith and allow this.
Well, it's really true. I wrote some about this in my book, Failed Evidence, and you really see it on full display here in the dissenting opinion in the Walker case. By Chief Justice Castile. In just the first 3 pages of that opinion, Justice Castile uses the word science or scientific or research and 10 times puts those words in quotes, you know, sort of derisive air quotes, you could think of it. He clearly does not believe that anything that is not hard science is real science. So he says, sure, using chemistry to determine What the identity of a substance is reliable, but social science on human nature just is not. It is inevitably subjective. And that frame of mind, I think, is responsible for a lot of the way that courts view a lot of the work on eyewitness testimony and false confessions. Yes, they are about human nature and human personality and the human mind. But what we should look at when we evaluate scientific work is not if it, not whether or not it's done in a traditional laboratory with beakers and test tubes and that sort of stuff. It doesn't have to be done that way. What counts is whether it is done rigorously by the scientific method. We have a hypothesis. It can be falsified. We test it rigorously. We use protocols in the testing that are customary for laboratory work. If we do that, the conclusions should be solid, whether they involve chemistry or human psychology. And I think that is a well-accepted definition of science, and clearly that is not where Justice Castillo finds himself.
We have a caller waiting on the line, but before we go to that, I want to ask you, will a court sometimes ignore facts and evidence to reach the decision it wants?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I mean, this is not something that is we're unaccustomed to seeing. We call this result-oriented decision-making. We like to think that most judges, most of the time, will view a case fairly, look at the facts objectively, and come to a real decision.
Yes,
no matter.
We would like to think that.
But, you know, look, human beings, judges are human beings. They don't always live up to that standard. We can't expect them to be perfect, but we should expect them to do it most of the time, if not all the time.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Joanne in Oakmont. Joanne, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi.
The question that I had was the false confession issue, expert testimony on false confession. Has that been decided in other state or federal jurisdictions?
Great question.
Yes, a great question, and it has been decided in some other jurisdictions. In fact, Justice McCaffrey, who wrote the opinion here in Pennsylvania, acknowledged that in the majority of jurisdictions that have looked at the issue, most allow expert testimony on false confessions. And he said, well, after looking at it, as well as with the opinions from other jurisdictions, and our own precedent, we are not persuaded by those other courts that have admitted this kind of expert testimony, and we elect to go the other way. And they agreed with the one court, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, that had prohibited expert opinion on false confessions. So there were decisions out there, not in Pennsylvania, but in other jurisdictions, other states. And Justice McCaffrey, for the majority, said, we're not going there.
Joanne, thank you for that call and your question. David, what impact might these two decisions have on the state's criminal justice system overall?
Well, they're going to have immediate impact in trials that involve either eyewitness identification or the possibility of a false confession, because the expert testimony either will, in eyewitness testimony, or will not, in false confession cases, be an available option. I hope it will also influence the work and the debate that is going on in Pennsylvania, albeit very slowly. We've had commissions about wrongful convictions. There has been debate about some of these issues at the state level. And I hope that will continue, that these cases will stimulate more debate, more thoughtful work by the commission. For instance, my colleague at Duquesne Law School, Professor Rago, he's been heavily involved in this. And our local district attorney, Stephen Zappala, has made some very good, very progressive moves on some of these issues. I hope that this will encourage that instead of cutting it off.
Yeah, and Stephen Zappala he's come to some interesting conclusions about this.
Yes, he has. He is willing. He's shown himself willing in several different instances to take a look at eyewitness procedures and try things like blind lineups. and to have regulations that or make statements that says he wants to see recording of confessions, electronic recording of confessions in cases. And he's gotten some compliance from, say, the Pittsburgh police and some of the other county jurisdictions. So I give him a lot of credit. He's doing more than a lot of other district attorneys in Pennsylvania are. But what we really need is a new state-level regime, new set of state-level laws and regulations that require us to be up with the best practices and not trailing behind many other states.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris has been my guest. David, as always, great thanks.
My pleasure, Paul. Good to be with you.
Coming up, how kids lose what they learn when they don't read during the summer months. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.